without the support from the Senate Finance Committee, I think it becomes challenging in some respects. And it's, you know, relationships are important in solving problems.
Governor Bill Walker hits pause on issuing bonds to pay for pensions. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state's economic downturn hits the Pick, Click, Give program.
This was the first year that the program saw a decrease from the year before.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
There are changes to the way you can share your thoughts or concerns with the University of Alaska Board of Regents. You can phone from anywhere in Alaska and provide your testimony to the Regents on Monday, October 31st from 4 to 6 p.m. or attend an informal evening gathering in Fairbanks on Thursday, November 10th from 5:30 to 7. You can also write to the Regents at alaska.edu/BOR/public-testimony. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
The state of Alaska won't issue bonds to pay for public worker pensions for now. Governor Bill Walker pressed pause on the sale today of up to $3.3 billion of pension obligation bonds after meeting with members of the Senate Finance Committee. While Walker's administration has the authority to issue the bonds, the legislature would have to appropriate money to pay them off. And senators have been skeptical of the plan. Some say it's too risky. Walker says it's more important that he maintain a good working relationship with the legislature than getting his way on the bonds.
I think it does still make economic sense, but I think that without the support from the Senate Finance Committee, I think it becomes challenging in some respects. And it's, you know, relationships are important in solving problems.
Walker says he believes the legislature will be willing to give the proposal consideration as they look for savings in next year's state budget. Walker says a comprehensive, sustainable fiscal plan is more important than any one approach, like the bonds, but he says it was a good time to act.
You look at these things when the interest rates are really low, and they're very low right now.
Senate Finance Co-Chair Anna McKinnon of Eagle River says she's thankful Walker listened to what committee members had to say.
I personally appreciate that he's put the bond sales on hold at this time, allowing for us to get into session or a better conversation going forward before he goes to market to ink or finalize any of those transactions.
Wasilla Republican Senator Mike Dunleavy has criticized Walker's plan, saying it was too risky and required more scrutiny from lawmakers. Standard & Poor's announced it expected to lower Alaska's credit rating if the state issued the bonds. The two other rating agencies didn't change their outlook of the state's ratings based on the bond plans. Pension obligation bonds have drawn criticism nationally. The Government Finance Officers Association says they involve considerable investment risk and recommends against state governments issuing the bonds. It has been a difficult year for nonprofits. The state's budget is shrinking, Alaskans' wallets are emptying, and for the first time since its inception in 2009, the Alaska Community Foundation's Pick, Click, Give program saw a drop in donations. The program allows Alaskans to donate a portion of their annual oil wealth payments to hundreds of nonprofits statewide. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, Rasha McChesney has more.
The people who donated a portion of their permanent fund dividend checks this year were generous. On average, they gave $108 per person, a record high since the program was created. But that generosity didn't quite make up for the drop in number of people who decided to donate.
This was the first year that the program saw a decrease from the year before.
That's Jason Gren, manager of the Alaska Community Foundation's Pick, Click, Give program. He's also an independent candidate for State House, challenging Republican Representative Liz Vasquez for her seat. Each year, when Alaskans sign up for their PFDs, they have an option to donate $25 or more to hundreds of nonprofit organizations across the state. And by most accounts, the program has been successful. Alaskans have given millions to organizations like Catholic Social Services, Public Media, food banks, and Planned Parenthood. This year, nearly $3.2 million was donated to more than 640 nonprofits, but that's down from $136,000 last year.
I think, you know, this year we saw less people giving who maybe realized, hey, I'm going to maybe need my PFD this year.
And there's a chance it could get worse for the program and the nonprofits that depend on it for revenue. When Alaskans decided to give this year, they didn't know that Governor Bill Walker was going to veto half of their dividend checks. Grin says that means they could be even less likely to donate next year. He says the Pick, Click, Give program will have to emphasize the importance of helping nonprofits, knowing that people might be hesitant to give. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a decades-long fight for justice.
After I ended up getting my letter of no funding and stuff, I said, just gave up in a sense.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. As an Alaskan, you love your salmon. But do you know the things you can do every day to make sure they're here for your children's children? Well, find out what you can do to ensure healthy runs for future generations of Alaskans at salmonproject.org/20ways. This message is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Nearly two decades ago, a Chugiak man filed a discrimination complaint against the Anchorage Airport. The investigation into the complaint took 5 years. Unhappy with its findings, he asked the state's ombudsman to take a second look. He's still waiting for an answer. On average, an investigation into a discrimination case in Alaska may take a year or two, according to the agencies that handle them. But KTOO's Lakedra Chavis has this investigation into two cases that fall far outside that average.
In his small living room in Chugiak, John Cedar is showing us shirts he made for a sled dog race in the late 80s when he raced poodles in the Iditarod.
This is when I ran in the, I think it was 1989 Iditarod.
But this story is about what happened in Cedar's life after that moment, when he started working for the Anchorage International Airport in the late 80s. He said when he first got there, everything was fine.
Then after I started meeting some of the black people there, the other minorities and the natives and the others, I started seeing that they were there many years longer than I was, and I was bypassing them. And so it started raising a red flag, what's going on here? Finally, things got worse.
Suter, who is white, says that some of his managers would call black Americans working at the airport the N-word. In one incident, which we'll revisit, he says a manager shot at one of the black men he worked with a noise-making pistol used to haze birds. He says some of his bosses were openly discriminatory against minorities. Suter was outraged. He went on multiple self-funded letter-writing campaigns.
Well, I'd be buying boxes of 500 envelopes and rolls of hundreds and hundreds of stamps.
He says he helped his coworkers write discrimination complaints to the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights, the state's anti-discrimination agency. Over the years, he'd sent media outlets and government officials more than 1,000 pages of emails, newspaper clippings, and case documents. He said he was reassigned to other departments and suspended because of his activism. Suter thought it was retaliation. He filed a discrimination case against the airport in 1997. 3 years later, he was fired. According to his termination letter, he was fired after multiple disciplinary actions for making false and misleading statements. Suter says he has yet to learn what those false statements were. Documents from interviews with management say Suter routinely got distracted from his job duties. 5 years after he filed his complaint, in 2002, the Human Rights Commission finished Suter's case. Case documents said his complaint was not supported by substantial evidence. But for Suter, that wasn't enough.
We went to the ombudsman because our complaint was that the Human Rights Commission is not providing due process for any one who goes there and files a human rights complaint that works for the state.
Notice how Suter says we. One of the people Suter worked with at the airport was a black American man named Theodore Burns. He goes by Teddy. He's the one Suter says he saw a manager shoot at with the small gun used to haze birds while he was sitting in a vehicle. The men think the incident happened because Burns is black. Burns also filed a case with the Human Rights Commission and was unhappy with the result. they appealed their cases with the Ombudsman's Office. The Ombudsman is a state agency that investigates citizen complaints against government agencies and officials. At his home in Anchorage's Mountain View neighborhood, Burns keeps a stack of binders filled with hundreds of papers in his bedroom.
And some of this stuff is what I ended up getting from the state. Doesn't make sense, right?
Burns filed a racial discrimination complaint against the airport because he was scared.
I was scared and it bothered me for probably years. It was like a, you know, like, I guess it'd be like being in a war, shell shock or something.
But Burns kept working at the airport. He still works there today as a senior equipment operator.
Well, it was a good job for one thing, you know. State jobs are hard to come by, you know, good benefits and stuff.
After 7 years, in 2011, the Ombudsman's Office resolved Burns' case.
I tried a lot of steps and stuff, and it's like spinning your wheels in the ice and snow in the mud. You think you're getting a little bit of traction, and all of a sudden you're slipping backwards.
According to the final Ombudsman's Report summary, the Human Rights Commission did indeed take too long to investigate his complaint. But the shooting incident couldn't be investigated because it exceeded the commission's statute of limitations for complaints. The investigator sided with the Human Rights Commission's findings that there wasn't discrimination. But John Souter's case, which has been at the Ombudsman's Office since 2004, is still underway. Then, like now, Linda Lord-Jenkins was the ombudsman. She's well aware of Souter.
Typically, they do not take that long. And yes, our work often depends on other factors. The other factors include caseload, incoming cases. They include staffing. They include the complexity of individual investigations.
Lord Jenkins wouldn't discuss Souter's case specifically, since it's still open. But she says in the mid-2000s, around the time when Souter and Burns filed their cases, the office had a small staff and an extreme increase in its caseload. She says the agency handles roughly 2,000 complaints a year. For very complex cases, the agency will open a full investigation into the complaint. Lord Jenkins says the investigations can take several years to complete.
I guess the only thing I want people to know is that when they come to us, they do get a thorough review of their complaints. And sometimes that takes a very long time.
But 12 years?
That's a good question. I think if you do a quick investigation and you don't look at all the pertinent factors, it's not worth anything. I would err on the side of thoroughness and untimeliness.
Here's Teddy Burns again.
After I ended up getting my letter of no finding and stuff, I said, like, just gave up in a sense. You know, and John is good. John doesn't forget anything.
In the past 2 years alone, Souter has emailed more than 50 legislators and staffers. Most of the lawmakers respond saying they won't help him because he's not a constituent. But Souter says he's come too far to quit.
I don't know. I guess I'm perplexed as how come I can't get somebody on board to say, you know, we ought to do something. We ought to go ahead and fix this.
Souter says he wants accountability, an audit on the Human Rights Commission and Ombudsman's Office. Both agencies were audited in 2011. Linda Lord-Jenkins from the Ombudsman's Office wouldn't say when she'd finish his case, but she emailed Souter and 13 lawmakers saying the preliminary report had been forwarded to the Human Rights Commission. The commission just needed to respond. That was in July 2015. Souter's state lawmakers, Representative Dan Sadler and Senator Bill Stoltz, declined to comment. Senator Britta Gardner was one of the people copied in that email. She says she couldn't help Souter because he isn't one of her constituents, but her office emailed the ombudsman about his case. She was surprised and upset to hear Souter's appeal is still ongoing.
What can happen this year that couldn't have happened last year or a decade ago?
She says she doesn't remember the specifics of Souter's case, but she says the point is the amount of time that's gone by.
Memories and data and all that stuff get harder and harder to access when it goes on this long. I think it's appalling and unjust. Whether he's right or wrong, it's unjust that this process should be, what is it now, 12 years?
So Souter, at least for now, is still waiting for an answer. Reporting from Juneau and Anchorage, I'm Lakita Chavis.
Tomorrow in part two, we'll take a closer look at the state's anti-discrimination agency, the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights. The University of Alaska Fairbanks is under fire for its response to a campus rape case. A UAF student accuses the university of failing to adequately support and protect her. And as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the criticism follows efforts by the university to improve its sexual assault response process.
19-year-old University of Alaska Fairbanks sophomore Jessie Wadham says she was raped at the Bartlett Hall dormitory on the first weekend of the semester after accepting a drink from a male student.
I'm assuming that after I no longer remember what happened, I kept getting plied with alcohol.
Wadham says her twin sister, also a UAF student, found her early the next morning, naked and unconscious, in the male student's room. She says she filed a police report, was treated at the hospital, and tried to go to classes, but things fell apart. The district attorney declined to press charges, and UAF allowed the student she says raped her back into Bartlett Hall.
When they made that decision, my anger shifted from, you know, my rapist to the university.
It feels like what's written into the process is a lack of humanity and compassion.
Jessie Wadham's mom and University of Alaska Associate Director of Public Relations Kate Wadham says she was there as the university system came under federal scrutiny in recent years for failing to properly adjudicate sexual assault cases.
I've been through a lot of the stuff that went on last year with the Title IX investigation. I was part of helping to organize that and be a part of that, and then to have this happen to my daughter was really, really difficult.
Kate Wadham says she's taking leave to help her daughter through what's turned out to be a less than proactive response from the university.
I was assured that there was a care team that was going to be emerging, and I was hoping that that care team would have a lead on it. None of those things happened. I became Jessie's advocate, and I became Jessie's care team.
Kate Wadham says she's tracking what's wrong with the system, but does not blame any single administrator for the failings. Requests for comment on the case were directed to UAF spokeswoman Marmion Grimes. Grimes says she can't talk about specifics, but defends a flexible system of victim support services, including housing and class schedule changes.
If someone feels like the services that the university has offered are not working well for them, they absolutely can ask for changes.
Grimes adds that it's understandable for a complainant to feel justice is not being served.
To want a respondent to be punished immediately. However, fairness does require that the university evaluate the complete evidence and all the circumstances.
Grimes stresses that Wadham's case remains under investigation, notes that the university has a lower burden of proof to find someone guilty, and can levy sanctions that include suspension and expulsion. In the meantime, Jessie Wadham is clear about what she wants.
Him off UAF campus so that I can take a semester off and come back to school next summer and feel safe at UAF.
Jessie Wadham's case has drawn support on campus and beyond since she went public with her story on Facebook.
I have people from all over, not just Alaska, but like women in Brazil and Argentina have messaged me too, saying, you know, I wish I had reported my rape, and so I'm doing it for them now, too.
The university does not have an expected completion date for an investigative report on the rape case. UAF Chancellor Dana Thomas is hosting a student forum on Title IX and other issues at the Moore Bartlett Scarlin dorm complex Sunday, October 30th. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story.
If you like to watch billionaires on television, you don't have to wait for Donald Trump to launch his own media network. The husband of Alaska Dispatch News owner Alice Rogoff now has his own primetime television talk show.
I began to take on the life of being an interviewer, even though I have a day job of running a private equity firm.
The David Rubenstein Show launched on Bloomberg Television last week. The series is billed as peer-to-peer conversations. For his first episode, Rubenstein starts at the top of the billionaire list with Microsoft founder Bill Gates.
You're the wealthiest man in the world for 20 years or more. Is that more of a burden than a pleasure to be the wealthiest man in the world?
Rubenstein is the co-founder of the Carlyle Group investment firm. He lives in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., and has been married to Rogoff for 33 years. She bought Alaska's largest newspaper in 2014. Rubenstein is number 290 on the Forbes list of richest Americans with a net worth of $2.4 billion. A newly awarded U.S. Department of Labor grant aims to bolster Alaska's healthcare and aviation industries. The grant will increase the use of apprenticeships, which the state hopes will boost the chances of companies hiring locally. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Ed Flanagan is the Director of Employment and Training Services for the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
It's been a priority project of the Alaska Workforce Investment Board and the administration to utilize the apprenticeship model to increase employment here, resident employment in a lot of industries that end up rehiring from out of state, and just generally provide career pathways so we can better move Alaskans into careers.
The more than $1 million grant focuses on two different industries, healthcare and aviation. Flanagan says the healthcare aspect is particularly important because the industry is still expected to grow despite tough economic times.
Particularly community health workers, which is a new emerging occupation, really, to coordinate care, reduce costs and reduce readmissions to hospitals and just generally improve the system.
According to data from the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development, the healthcare and social assistance sector is projected to add more than 7,000 jobs by 2024. And in rural areas, he says jobs within the aviation industry, like air dispatchers, can also be localized.
They're bringing them up to Kotzebue from Anchorage 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. Well, maybe somebody in Kotzebue could be trained up through apprenticeship to have that job, and it'd be a great local job in their own economy.
By using apprenticeship programs, which combine on-the-job training and classroom instruction, Flanagan says more Alaskans will be qualified to work in the industries.
We've got to do everything we can, and apprenticeship just seems to provide a really good opportunity to get folks on the first ladder and beyond into these careers for generally good-paying jobs, generally with benefits, and for the family wage job.
The Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development is coordinating with local industry groups, Alaska Primary Care Association and Alaska Air Carriers Association, to expand apprenticeship opportunities in the state. The grant also aims to reduce Alaska's unemployment rate, which, as of September, stands at 6.9%. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Next year, the Homer Harbor will be a lot brighter. The Homer City Council recently authorized the installation of new LED lights around the harbor. KBBI reporter Shayla Farzan has the story.
Homer will soon join the list of U.S. cities making the switch to LED lights. Under a newly approved city ordinance, the Port and Harbor Department will outfit 7 high-mast poles around the Homer Harbor with high-brightness LEDs. Originally, the Port and Harbor Department had planned to install LEDs on a single pole as a test project. But the City Council voted down that ordinance in favor of an expanded project that will install lights on all 7 poles. The estimated price tag for the project is $180,000. Brian Hawkins is the port director for the city of Homer. Though the LED lights are expensive, he says they're worth the investment.
We think we're using about $66,000 worth of electricity last year, and these lights will use half that much, so we'll save $33,000. We will pay ourselves back for the investment in 4 years.
And that's not counting lower maintenance costs, says Hawkins. Traditional high-pressure sodium bulbs, like the ones currently used in the Homer Harbor, must be replaced every 2 to 5 years. Based on current estimates, the lifespan of an LED light bulb is about 15 to 20 years.
Besides the cost savings, Hawkins says the brighter LED bulbs will help improve security in the harbor.
What we're actually doing is we're watching over hundreds of millions of dollars of public and private property there.
The ordinance approving the LED light project passed unanimously at the Homer City Council meeting on October 10th. But at least one outside group thinks Homer should proceed cautiously. Pete Strasser works with the International Dark Sky Association, a nonprofit based in Arizona. He's watched communities across the country make the move to LEDs. In foggy coastal environments, the glare from high-brightness LEDs can be a major issue, says Strasser.
One of the problems that people discover, usually to their chagrin, is that high-brightness white LEDs and fog or haze or snow puts out a tremendous amount of glare.
Because LEDs produce much more light than older technologies, light pollution is also a big concern.
The nighttime environment has never had the amount of light that's going to be thrown at it ever before.
To help avoid these issues, Homer Port and Harbor has proposed putting a shield around the new LEDs to direct light towards the ground. The shield looks like a baseball cap brim. But Strasser says a light shield alone won't fix the glare issue. One option to reduce glare is to select LED lights with an amber-colored coating.
That is the perfect locale for amber LEDs. And that would essentially be like putting out fog lights to illuminate the area instead of a high-brightness white. If they put in high-brightness white LEDs on those high masts, the glare would be unbelievable.
The Port and Harbor Department has not yet made a decision about what type of LED lights will be installed. Now that the City Council has approved the ordinance, City Manager Katie Kester will issue a formal request for proposals from interested companies. The installation of the new LED lights in the Homer Harbor could begin as early as spring 2017. In Homer, I'm Shayla Farzan.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman, Rasha McChesney, and Lakeed Rashavis in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Josh Edge in Anchorage, and Shayla Farzan in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
There are changes to the way you can share your thoughts or concerns with the University of Alaska Board of Regents. You can phone from anywhere in Alaska and provide your testimony to the Regents on Monday, October 31st from 4 to 6 p.m. or attend an informal evening gathering in Fairbanks on Thursday, November 10th from 5:30 to 7. You can also write to the Regents at alaska.edu/BOR/public-testimony. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska. Alaska has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation, but together we can change that one life at a time. The Statewide Suicide Prevention Council has the resources and training to prevent suicide and support healing for individuals in need. Be the one to ask if someone is thinking about suicide and connect them to help. Visit StopSuicideAlaska.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.